The Senate Veterans and Military Affairs Finance and Policy Committee will come to order, and we will begin our morning with the Pledge of Allegiance. Please rise and join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. Thank you. Thank you, members. And I'm glad that we've got a full committee here today, and we're looking forward to hearing from our new commissioner and others as we get into our agenda. I would like to first start out by saying that our committee has basically stayed the same as far as Senate members, but we have some new people here along with our pages that I would like to have them just introduce themselves. And let's start with the front row here. As far as on our committee, we have a new research person, and if she would mind introducing herself. She's not really new to the Senate, but she's new to this committee. So, Ms. White.
Mr. Chair, members, my name's Joan White, and I used to staff the Human Services Committee for several years. And I wanted to try something new, so I'm staffing this committee, higher ed and local government, and I look forward to working with all of you.
We look forward to your presence on our committee. Thank you for being here. We have some new pages that have joined us, and if they wouldn't mind stepping out, giving us their names and kind of a little bit of a thumbnail sketch of who you are. Welcome, Travis. Welcome, Anna. We look forward to you helping us out, and hopefully we can be of assistance in any way for your stay with us. So thank you for being a part of us. Anything that the members have to share with us before we get into our presentations this morning? Just want to give you a chance to, you know, you guys don't like to talk much, so I know what. Want you to loosen up those vocal cords and say your piece. Any thoughts? Okay, I didn't give you much time, did I? our first person that's coming forward this morning, it's an opportunity to meet our new commissioner of the Department of Veterans Affairs, Mr. Larry Herkey, and his staff and others that will be working with him, and we will be working with him also, and hopefully as he learns his new title and new different pieces of his job, that we can have interaction with him. So, Mr. Herkey, I look forward to hearing you come and speak to us, and if you introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony, that would be fantastic. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Senators. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today. I am Larry Herkey. I am the new commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, and I am from St. Sauk Center, Minnesota, is where I hail from today. And just an opportunity to sort of introduce myself and tell you a little bit about me and maybe some of the priorities we're looking at here going forward. I am a Minnesota boy. I've been here my entire life. Grew up originally in Mankato, Minnesota. Went to Mankato East High School and graduated from Mankato State University. Now Minnesota State University, Mankato. I undergraduate degree in accounting and a graduate degree in public administration. I was one of the first members of the ROTC program in Mankato that went for the full 4 years. Graduated from that and went on active duty a few days after graduation. Served as an air defense officer in Germany for 4 years. Came off of active duty and then became a member of the Minnesota Army National Guard. During my time there, I did get married to my wife. I've been married 33 years to Debbie. And we lived together, as I said, in Sauk Center, Minnesota. I had three sons. One of my sons actually served in the Minnesota National Guard for a period of about 6 years. Throughout my leadership, I had an opportunity. I was one of those rare people that couldn't keep a job, it seemed like. We moved from a lot of different branches in the military. Started out, as I said, in air defense. Worked as a cavalry officer in a cavalry squadron, as a troop commander, company commander for an anti-armor company in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Was a battery commander in St. James, Minnesota. So I got a chance to see a lot of the National Guard and serve with a lot of soldiers throughout the Minnesota Army National Guard. I did go and deploy to Iraq and was there on the extended tour with the 1st Brigade of the 34th Division. Opportunity to be the chief of staff there of a 5,200 member brigade. And it was a great opportunity to put skills I'd learned over several years of being in the military and being able to do it in a real world environment. Upon completion of deployment, I got to serve as a battalion commander of a special troops battalion in Bloomington, Minnesota. And then after that, I was assigned to a couple specialty jobs, one as the mobilization officer, where I actually mobilized over 10,000 soldiers in preparation for ongoing Iraqi freedom and enduring freedom. My last position was actually as the construction and facilities management officer for the state of Minnesota, where I was responsible for the armories and the training site buildings at Camp Ripley and at Arden Hills, plus two flight facilities and several logistics facilities, maintenance facilities throughout the state of Minnesota. And that's where I actually got involved in sustainability, which actually led to my follow-on job. After retiring, after 31 years in the military, I was retired for 2 days and got an opportunity to come here and work for former Commissioner Matt Mossman in the Department of Administration. I was the first Director of Sustainability for the state of Minnesota. In that position, I actually worked with and for all 24 cabinet-level agencies. So I got an opportunity to see how the different agencies within Minnesota actually operate. We've helped them to put together plans for reduction of their solid waste, water, greenhouse gases, to get better procurement, to reduce their energy, and also their consumption of fossil fuels through their fleets. We put together the first annual report in 2017, which actually gave the full impact of state government on the environment and on society. I'm pretty proud of that. We actually won the governor's best government award for that particular document that we put together. People ask what kind of leader I am, and I know the Adjutant General's coming up later. He could probably tell you, but I try to lead by example. I'm a compassionate leader. I'm hardworking. I'm pretty tenacious. If people tell me something can't be done, I'm probably going to be the guy that's going to try to prove them wrong. I like to keep a smile on my face and a kind word for individuals. I think that goes a long ways. I like collaborative partnerships and so forth. One example of that is I was able to do a public-private partnership with Minnesota Power at Camp Ripley, and we actually were able to get 10 megawatts of solar installed there, and it became a win-win-win situation for society, for Morrison County, because we didn't take farmland out of production. It's a good thing for resilience for Camp Ripley, and it was a good thing for Minnesota Power also. It helped them go towards their statutory requirements for solar within the state of Minnesota. So I'd like very much find collaborative opportunities when I can. I did want to mention a couple priorities that these are early priorities that I'm working on. The first one is veterans homelessness, and that's an area that I really, really think the time has come to fix the problem. There's 237 known homeless veterans in Minnesota today, and I think we're at a point where we can fix this problem if we focus in on it. Second area I'm looking at is targeting outreach to the Iraqi Freedom and Enduring Freedom veterans and Gulf War vets. It's a group of people that serve their nation sometimes with multiple deployments, and I think they're at a situation in their lives, a lot of them now, where they really could use some of our services. They probably didn't think so when they came off of their deployments or their active duty periods, but I think it's really a situation where we need to sort of catch these people now and make sure that they're woven into the different systems so that we don't have greater problems in the future. The third area that I'm looking at is reducing operating costs through the facilities. We own about 1.2 million square feet of facilities in the Veterans Affairs, and I'd like to look at see that what opportunities we can have there just to make them more efficient overall, sort of applying my sustainability background to be able to do that. I would like to put together a facility renovation and replacement plan. It's something that the agency currently doesn't have going forward, just so we understand, you know, when is it that we need to renovate, when are the money, different inputs of money going to be required, and be more proactive rather than reactive to situations within our facilities. And lastly, I've been empowered, or been told by the governor that to overlook and make sure that we have on track the three new veterans' homes that are have been passed as far as the capital portion of that has been passed, but to make sure that they come off on schedule, that we have the right staffing and they're trained to the right levels, and then we have all the pieces and parts to include the federal match that's required to build those homes, to get that in place and be successful in the implementation of those three new facilities. I look forward to representing Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I love the mission of helping veterans and veterans' families, and I'm honored to be appointed as the 18th commissioner for this agency, and I look forward to working with the Senate and this committee specifically as we go forward. And I'd be open at this point to any questions, Mr. Chairman, that the committee would have for me.
Thank you, Commissioner Herkey. I appreciate the insight and a little bit of background. I was, when I first heard you were assigned as the new commissioner, I kept asking around, who's this Larry Herkey? And I got next to our new senator from up in Cold Spring, Senator Jeff Howe. And Senator says, well, I served with Colonel Herkey. And I said, oh, what kind of man is he? He said, well, every time I go home at night or come in the morning, he'd either be sleeping on his computer or he'd be still working from the night before. So I go, man, that guy never quits. And he said, you're right. He'll outwork you any day of the week. So I just got a little bit of tidbit of how tenacious and how aggressive you are and wanting to see a job started and completed, and you'll go to any ends to make that happen. And that's just one comment from a former service member who served with you as a fellow Army friend and comrade. So questions for Commissioner Herkey? Don't all speak at once. No questions? Oh, come on. Got to have some. Okay. Senator Rood.
Mr. Herkey, I just want to say thank you, and we look forward to working with you. I know the Camp Ripley project was amazing. I was there for the groundbreaking of the solar project, and so and I love the fact that you acknowledge that we have, and you know the number of homeless veterans that we have in Minnesota, and so I think that that's something we really need to work on, because, you know, that's kind of an unacceptable number, and we need to bring them into a home and bring them home. So welcome aboard. We really look forward to working with you this year.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, sir, for your service and for stepping up to this position. I'm really glad to hear that you're looking into how we can be more effective and efficient with our department. And I like the idea that you're going to be more proactive in the renovation and repairs of the facilities. Being totally reactive costs a lot of money, and it doesn't cause a lot of angst. So I appreciate your bringing that up. And, you know, I hope with the 237 vets that are homeless that we know of, I sincerely hope we can help those folks out and get them the care that they need. And I commend you for, you know, helping out in that area. And I look forward to those three new vet homes, too, because it's going to be a blessing for the families of the vets that are needing those. And so I'm a project manager and an engineer, so I like to hear being on time, on schedule, on budget, and having everything ready to roll when we get done and be up and running in a timely fashion. So thank you very much, sir.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, thank you.
Senator Jerry Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for the visit and for our discussion concerning the veterans' homes. I'm encouraged to hear that you want to work with our more recently deployed veterans. I think that we don't have sufficient follow-up to make sure that they're getting what they need and they're getting especially mental health care if they need it to do what they have to do to lead a normal life. And in that regard, I would like to continue discussions about our county veteran services officers, perhaps getting them additional funding and doing more outreach to these recently deployed vets. So thank you.
Any other questions? It's always interesting. I'm in the process of doing a Bible study, and I was looking. They were talking in the first book of Samuel, and it talked about the size of a division. You mentioned the 34th division, and then a brigade. And I started looking up those terms, and the terms really didn't give me any idea of what the size of those two were. And I thought, division's got to be pretty big, and there's got to be, you know, and a brigade's got to be even bigger. But I just give us a thumbnail sketch of what you're. How many men, approximately, women included in a division or in a brigade?
Mr. Chairman, there's, of course, many different types of brigades, and divisions can be made up of many different brigades. But I think as a general rule, a brigade would be 3,500 to up to, our brigade was a fairly large brigade at 5,200 members. Again, a lot of these formations are really tailored to the mission that they required to do. So there's a lot of flexibilities in the numbers. I think divisions start somewhere right around the 15,000 mark is a normal division size, but again, they could be smaller or larger depending on the mission required for that division.
Now I have something to tell my classmates. So I look forward to working with you, Commissioner Herkey, and look forward to the different priorities that you've stated, and I'm sure there's going to be other things that are going to come up in your day-to-day and your monthly, and as you go along, things are going to change as those priorities get faced and challenged, and you get challenged by them. I like the opportunity to see the targeting, as Senator Newton already mentioned, those people coming back from Iraqi and enduring freedom, and I was a part of that when I was in the Air National Guard for that, and the Gulf War vets. So it's very meaningful to see you're wanting to reach out to them and help them in any way that they can and their families. So it's rewarding to hear those statements. Before we quit, is there anything else that you members have to? Senator Herr.
Thank you very much, and congratulations, Commissioner Herkey. My question is not to the commissioner, but I just want to, are we sometime down the road will be confirming commissioner, or will this be the process today? Or?
That's a very likely happening, but when that's going to happen, I can't tell you.
Okay. But welcome aboard, and, you know, one, I just want to bring to your attention that one group of veterans that I represent are the Special Guerrilla Unit veterans, and there'll be every now and then that I'll be talking about them or put legislation forth to support them. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Commissioner Herkey, thank you for your presentation, and we'll look forward to seeing you around, and hopefully, I'm guessing, probably visiting some of the senators' offices as time goes on. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Our next presentation is from the Department of Veterans Affairs. And, of course, that is in conjunction with the new commissioner, Ben Johnson, the legislative director. So welcome to committee, Mr. Johnson, and please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Ben Johnson. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. Lots of familiar faces in the room, so long story short, I spent 6 years in the Navy active duty, deployed twice in support of OEF, OIF. I did a third deployment in South America, working with the Coast Guard doing counter-drug operations. I've been with the agency for about 3 years now. My wife and I are both originally from Minnesota, so to get back to Minnesota and work with this organization and this group of individuals is really important to me. I'm here today to give a quick overview of the agency and our operations. The commissioner has graciously offered to stay up here with me to answer any questions that I might not know answers to. You've seen this before. There are a few updates, and please feel free to interject with any questions during the presentation. I'm happy to answer them in turn or at the end. So in the agency overview, we'll talk about our programs and services division, we'll talk about our healthcare division, and then a quick update on the new state veterans homes. I had some trouble with my Outlook last night, and so the slide with the new homes information is not in your handout, but it is in this packet and has been saved to this desktop. So if you need to refer to that, and we can also follow up with additional details as that comes up. So you've seen these statements before. We are still committed to serving veterans and their families in the state of Minnesota. We do that through programs and services that maximize their quality of life, both proven and we work to develop new strategies to strive to serve our veterans and their families and the communities that they live in. Again, programs and services, most of that population is either in St. Paul or scattered throughout the state. And then the healthcare division are primarily at our five state veterans homes. A lay of the land. Currently, Minnesota has approximately 327,000 veterans. All 87 counties are represented. And you'll note in that graphic on the left, 65 to 74 is the largest concentration of veterans, which means that our veterans population is aging. Commensurately, we have our largest portion of veterans who saw service in Vietnam comprise that group. The gender breakdown is, there's an extra zero there, 8% women, 9% men. That number is expected to, the women are expected to grow to approximately 15% of the demographic by 2030. That is a result of more women serving and more women coming home to Minnesota as veterans. So our programs and services division assists veterans and their families with access to benefits that they have earned, benefits that they're entitled to, a wide variety of programs available through the state and also with our partners in the counties and at the federal level. We administer these programs on behalf of veterans, and our focus in recent years has been on those veterans in need of additional services who can't afford to access them on their own. So we've got some great program available for low-income or limited asset veterans and their families. There's an overview of the areas that programs and services seeks to address, and the following slides will capture each of these individually. Again, any questions or concerns while I'm going through, please feel free to interrupt. Our federal claims assistance, we have a location at the Whipple Building in St. Paul and another up in Fargo, and we work with veterans to file claims for federal benefits. We work with veterans to file appeals for claims that have been denied. We work with pension assistance, evaluation of VA decisions, and we partner with our county veteran service officers to develop these claims. We also have field and tribal operations, which are located throughout the state, and that's how we do outreach to claimants who wouldn't normally seek assistance from their CVSOs or come into our offices in St. Paul, whether it be due to geography or due to a hesitancy to access federal or state benefits through the state. We do outreach on the indigenous, on the tribal lands and on the reservations that we have in Minnesota. A quick note about that demographic, that the Native American population serves as a higher percentage of their overall population than any other demographic in the state. So our outreach to the tribes is very important to us and something we take seriously.
Mr. Johnson, question. We were just mentioning this morning prior to coming into that there are still veterans that do not use services from the VA or from Minnesota. And I'm wondering if you have any kind of an idea, a ballpark figure of what, how many out there are, percentage of vets that do not, that take advantage of what's been offered to them by either the state or the federal government.
Chair, members, I actually don't have a specific number in mind. Out of the 327 that we're aware of, again, that's based on census data.
Right.
So it's not a head-by-head count. One of the challenges that we do face is that if a veteran has no interest in accessing programs or services and is not in the VA healthcare system, simply of their own choosing, it's hard to get a grasp on how many of those there are. And the other challenge that we face is that the veterans who do access those programs, they overlap in a lot of areas. So we would have a challenging time counting someone who might seek health care through the Minneapolis VA and also come to us to seek burial in one of our state veteran cemeteries. We don't have the specific number on that, but we can determine. I can get an answer to you that would give you a ballpark figure.
That would be great. Thank you. Any other questions? Please continue.
So within programs and services, we have our higher education veterans program. This works with veterans who are seeking higher education access to the state colleges and university system, University of Minnesota, and our private colleges. We work to help administer the federal GI Bill, make sure that there are veterans resource centers on our campuses or there is a veterans resource officer available to help our veterans continue their higher education. An additional component of it is, in addition to the federal GI Bill, Minnesota has a GI Bill. It's a $10,000 amount available to as a last dollar in program to all Minnesota veterans, regardless of their level up to age 62, because after age 62, there are opportunities for free access to colleges and continuing education. So $10,000, and we have recently been able to expand the scope of the Minnesota GI Bill to include not only the traditional education, but also will include access to things like on-the-job training and apprenticeship programs, as well as licensing and certification. This is a recent change. Allows someone who's seeking a nursing license to access their Minnesota GI Bill benefits to pay for the application fee for that. Typically, those licenses aren't cheap. In training programs to complete a licensure, we want to make sure that if they've utilized their federal benefits to the extent that there's none left, that they have some assistance to make sure they get that license so that they can get into a career. Also within our education and employment team, the state approving agency is an important component of our program. Works with the federal VA and state to make sure that the training programs and colleges are on par with what the federal requirements are. We make sure that the schools who are doing these programs are meeting the requirements of the federal VA so that they continue to be eligible to receive federal funding. It's an interesting juxtaposition of a state and federal program. We want to make sure that all of our veterans in Minnesota have access to programs that will give them a degree that they can use. And if a school doesn't meet the federal requirements, either the degree might not be worth as much or the federal VA might not be reimbursing that school if they're not meeting those requirements. So that's our state approving agency's job.
Mr. Jensen?
Yes, sir.
Of those veterans who are using GI benefits and going to schools, is there a breakout as to more going to universities or more going to tech schools or more going to, specialized schools that they would like to be a part of? Yeah. Any idea of what that breakout is?
I don't have that specific number. I know we heard from Gina Sabania, who is down at Minnesota State Mankato, and she told us that it really is contingent on what the economy is doing and what choices veterans make in their schooling. If it's a poor economy, more are in school, more are in OJT and apprenticeship training programs. So it really is contingent on how things are going in terms of their enrollment, and that holds true throughout the state, both for four-year colleges and the technical education. But in terms of the specific numbers, I can get that information and get it to you.
Thank you.
And so I mentioned the OJT and apprenticeship program. This is also available through the Minnesota GI Bill. And one of the nice aspects of the OJT and apprenticeship is that we are also, not only are we reimbursing a student for accessing education in a particular technical field, we're also interested in making sure that the employer is compensated. We want to make it as easy as possible for someone to give a veteran an opportunity to get their license in as an electrician or to get their journeyman as a carpenter. And so we want to make sure that those who are providing on-the-job training are also compensated. So there are reimbursements to the employer as well. And it makes it a lot easier for us to encourage people to take a chance on a veteran. That program in and of itself has seen a significant increase in recent years. And primarily that's due to outreach from our education team going to the union halls and going around the state and making sure that those that are interested in doing non-traditional or more technical schools have access to the data about what we can help them accomplish.
Mr. Johnson, how many veterans have their own businesses now? Do you know how many people who have come out of the Gulf War or the Enduring Freedom or these situations and have become business people and are, contributing back? I know that we've had a discussion several years ago about veteran-owned businesses trying to get business with the state of Minnesota and federal contracts and things like that. I'm just curious as to what veterans have accomplished as far as picking up the ball and being a carpentry or having their own business. And just, again, look up for those, and I'll wait for your feedback.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. We would be
Senator Newton.
Mr. Johnson, on the veterans reimbursement for the veterans training program, does that include training that's offered by our labor unions as well, like the 49ers or IBEW for their programs?
Chair Anderson, Senator Nooney, yes, I believe that it does.
Thank you.
So next up through our programs and services is the State Soldiers Assistance Program. And now this is where I started with the agency. It is direct assistance to veterans, low income and low asset most typically. It's a way to help offset costs if they're unable to pay their bills, their mortgage or rent payments. It's a way to offer them access to dental care. We work with a voucher program and dental providers in the community who are willing to take a voucher from us to provide annual checkups and care. If it's gotten to the point where a veteran needs dentures, the dental program offers funding for extractions and dentures, which is not an insignificant cost. So this is a program that is, again, a public-private partnership, and we work with providers in the community to offer these services. We also have an optical benefit, and that can be extended to families as well to get glasses to veterans who may need access to that. The special needs grant is one that you might have heard of. Most veterans in the state have an idea that they've got $5,000 out there with their name on it. In some regards, that's accurate. The special needs grant is a one-time grant, one-time use. The amount is typically up to $5,000, and it's for a catastrophic event in a veteran's life that perhaps my favorite example is January in Minnesota and your water heater or your heating system breaks down, and you don't have $5,000 in the bank to replace it. You can work with your county veteran service officer to submit an application for a special needs grant. And it's, again, an emergency use one time in their life, but it's a way to make sure that that they don't fall behind the curve and that they're not looking for some recurring assistance. If we can get them the money they need to make that significant repair or investment in themselves and their family, then the sustainable aspect going forward is key. We're proud of the special needs grant. lots of people know about it but don't know what it really is. And so we generally direct people who are interested in accessing special needs to their county veteran service officers. I'll take a page out of our annual report and suggest to you that we have at least 65 stakeholder groups working with us in the state of Minnesota. That doesn't include the county veteran service officer who's located in every county in the state of Minnesota. Those with a larger veterans population, Hennepin County, Ramsey County, up in Anoka, down in Dakota County, have multiple CVSOs. But they are our boots on the ground. They don't work for the state of Minnesota. They are county employees. There are pass-through grants available to them from the legislative appropriations. But they are a key component of how we access veterans in the community to make sure that that they know what services are available. They do both state and federal programs, everything from basic health care access to at the VA to, in the end, they work with us to help get access to our cemeteries or, if need be, the federal cemetery at Fort Snelling. Going back to the commissioner's comments about his priorities, one area that programs and services utilizes significantly is Minnesota Services Corps, which is case management, outreach, referral, and education. This is a contract that MDVA has with Lutheran Social Services to provide case management, therapy, whether it be financial counseling, mental health counseling. This is a way for veterans in greater Minnesota specifically to access mental health services. It's a very successful program. It's something that is a contract program with Lutheran Social Services, who have been a great partner of ours. It is one of those programs that it's you think it's hard to put a number in, but in terms of the access to these kinds of programs, we have utilized every dollar that is available to us through that appropriation. We've gone back and subsidized it in order to continue, because Lutheran Social Services has been able to utilize their contract to get these funds. Last year, for instance, every dollar was utilized plus an additional appropriation from our SSAP program, and they still ran out of money with a month left on the calendar, the fiscal year. And LSS was gracious enough to offer their services through the end of the contract at no cost to MDVA. That's the kind of partner they are, because they recognize the value of the services that they're providing, and we're eternally grateful for that collaboration. And we're really excited about where that program is going. We recognize the need and are continuing to try and support it as much as possible. Within the programs and services, we also have our state veteran cemeteries. We have Little Falls, which has been open for more than 25 years. Recently opened the Preston Cemetery, and we'll be doing a grand opening of the Duluth location this coming year. We have legislative authorization to pursue one more down in Redwood County, southwestern Minnesota. It is oftentimes, to your question about how many are accessing programs and services or any services through the VA, oftentimes burials at one of our cemeteries is the only thing that a veteran or their family is asking for. But we provide dignified burial services. We have color guards, and we're very proud of our locations and the work that our teams do out there. I mentioned the grant programs. These are some examples. I won't go through them line by line, but CVSO has received grants. Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, MACV, some of you might know, offers access to housing solutions for veterans. They're one of our partners in that regard. The Veterans Service Organization grants are with our partners in the VFW, Legion, DAV, you name it. Those congressionally chartered veterans organizations can access grants as well. And then our final is the Support Our Troops license plates. The Support Our Troops Fund comes from contributions by members of the public who are purchasing those Support Our Troops license plates, and then that fund is distributed half and half between Military Affairs and MDVA, and we are able to offer grants to organizations looking to develop, we like to say, novel approaches to veterans issues. So it's not the established programs. It's someone who has a good idea about funding service animals or equestrian therapy or music therapy, art therapy, different ways to try and access veterans from the Vietnam conflict and before, as well as our returning veterans who might have a different idea about what they need to help with mental health or reengagement. And last but not least in this regard, our Homeless Veterans Initiative. We have our Homeless Program Coordinator and our Veterans SOAR Program. Those two are combining forces. SOAR is an office that we use to help our homeless veterans access things like SSI and SSDI to get them some financing. We want to make sure that any veteran that comes in the door has some sort of resolution. The commissioner mentioned the number of veterans on the Homeless Veterans Registry. I would also like to highlight that in the last 5 years, we have found housing solutions for 1,650 veterans. So 1,650 veterans who had been identified as either homeless or in danger of becoming homeless through our collaboration through the Homeless Veterans Program. We have been successful in a lot of regards. And so those that are on the list are some of the hardest to house, and the current housing market is challenging. I think we're looking at less than 2%. Less than 2% vacancy in the metro area, so that is one of our big challenges. But I do like to commend the team that we work with, all the organizations that partner with us on the Homeless Veterans Registry. 1,650 or more veterans have been housed in the last 5 years, and the trajectory of the number of veterans that we're locating that are in need of services and good housing outcomes for them, the trajectory is up. So we're identifying fewer and finding solutions for more veterans. Over the last 2 months, the trajectory has been a net positive in the last 2 months, which is the first two consecutive months we've had in the last 5 years. So the method is working, and we're excited about continuing to support it and continue to create ways to find housing for veterans. So as I mentioned earlier, we have 5 veterans' homes in the state of Minnesota, 4 skilled nursing facilities, Silver Bay, Fergus Falls, Laverne, and Minneapolis. We also have a board and care facility, or you might know it as a domiciliary, down in Hastings. We also have a building at Minneapolis that does domiciliary. Those programs are combined with one set of administration, but the two locations are currently in existence. So as I mentioned earlier, we do have an aging veterans population. Vietnam era and those 65 to 74 are some of our highest concentration, and that number is expected to double. 65 and over is expected to double in the next 10 years. In Minnesota, more than 1 in 5 will be what is politely called an older adult, which includes the entire baby boom generation, which is the wave of the aging population that is coming at us now. Our goal at our veterans' homes and the healthcare side is to meet the needs of our aging veterans population. We want to make sure that we have the clinical capacity to serve our veterans. We have been able to sustain our operations at the existing homes. I'll talk a little bit later about the expansion of some of the services that we provided, and also the complete overhaul of the infrastructure at the Minneapolis home, as well as the contributions that the legislature has supported in terms of asset preservation. We've made some great strides in updating and making sure that our facilities are the best that they can be. We're committed to ensuring fiscal integrity at our homes. We're optimizing supplemental resources, which is in some cases something as simple as accessing the Medicare program on behalf of our residents, making sure that the federal government is footing the bill for those who are eligible for that program. We're developing cost control and budget management measures, and it's something that the commissioner alluded to. It's something that we are committed to, and we'll continue to work with the legislature and the governor's office to make sure that that we're utilizing our resources the best that we can, including the staffing and operations of our homes. There are, as the commissioner mentioned, opportunities to make our facilities more cost-effective in terms of energy savings, and we will explore all opportunities and support the commissioner's position on that in every way that we can. We'll also be looking to you for support in making sure that the investments in that infrastructure are funded at the adequate level. So it's a foreshadowing, I assume, but we will be looking for assistance on your part to make sure that our homes are the best that they can be. Again, won't read through the list, but we offer a lot of services to our residents This is not an exhaustive list, but we're excited about the things that we provide. And I will highlight the adult daycare at the Minneapolis campus. The adult day center is not it does not count against our residents' count. It is veterans still living at home who can access care service, and we call it respite for their caregivers. So an aging veteran is living at home with his wife. She can bring him in the morning to our adult day center at Minneapolis, drop him off. There's a day full of programming. If there's need for some medical assistance, bathing, showering, things like that, we can provide that so that his or her caregiver can go and take care of things like groceries or maybe just go get a cup of coffee. It's one of the few in the nation. I think there are only three. We're really proud of the program, and one of our biggest challenges is making sure that those who are close enough to access it know about it. Our goal is to keep veterans in the least restrictive environment possible and in their homes for as long as possible. We feel that's the best place for them. So we like to highlight this offering, and we're very proud of it.
The adult daycare, we have a private adult daycare in Buffalo where the local trailblazer, like a Metro Mobility, comes and picks up people and brings them to the adult daycare. And my father-in-law, who was an Army major, retired World War II, used to use that on a regular basis. And I'm just wondering if you have any, I mean, you have it here in Minneapolis, but are there any collaboratives that you're working with, like others, you know, where you have nursing homes in other locations, Laverne or places like that, that you could say you could have a opportunity for an adult daycare if they have one already in their city, excuse me, that you could work in veterans along with that?
I appreciate the suggestion, Chair, and it's something that we've considered. We haven't. We're currently working on the business operations at the Minneapolis home. Again, one of our challenges is that we can't seem to keep the census up, and so we're trying to bolster the business operations with as many individual users as we can here. And once we've established the best program for that, we'll look for collaborations elsewhere. I will note that the federal VA does contract skilled nursing beds in some throughout the state of Minnesota with private providers for skilled nursing. They also do in-home care, and so you can receive care from providers in-home. So if residents are still living at home in Minnesota, there are options for having a nurse practitioner, having a nursing assistant or someone in that vein come to the home and provide medical care, help with bathing, that sort of thing. So that's where our healthcare leadership came from before they joined MDVA, have a lot of experience with that sort of thing. So we try and maximize those partnerships and make sure that veterans have access to care in their home as well.
Very good. Senator Housley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I was just wondering with the adult daycare, is it if it's the veteran who doesn't need the care but they are the caregiver, are they allowed to drop their spouse off for the adult daycare, or is it only if the veteran needs the care?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to it, but I'll find out for you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Senator Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the services that are offered, are any of those offered to the veterans community at large? Or is this only for the veterans who are in our facilities?
Mr. Johnson.
Chair, Senator Newton, the Adult Day Center is open to any veteran and potentially spouse. That we'll have to look into that. That one in particular is. And I'll get to a slide on our new fixed dental clinic that we're working on an agreement with the Minneapolis VA on taking some of their overflow cases. For the most part, most of our health care provision is to the residents of our homes or domiciliary.
Hey, Mr. Chair, if I can continue, for the rehab services, those are strictly limited to people who are residents of the home. Is that correct?
Mr. Johnson.
Chair, Senator Newton, the therapy and the offerings that we have at the homes are for residents of the homes at this time. We are their primary care provider, so our programming is specifically for those residents.
Please proceed.
Speaks for itself. It's our brag sheet. We're really proud of the work that we've done to improve in all these areas, and these are all things where we've been awarded best in class in these categories. So this is Minneapolis Building 22, which is the third new building at Minneapolis. Phase three completes our renovation and update of the campus. We opened last year. It replaced a building that was no longer serving the needs of veterans. We took Senator Newton's suggestion to heart and sought CMS certification for all of our facilities. And in that regard, we noted that some of the facilities didn't offer the ability to accomplish that. So Building 22 is the third. We just opened, or will be opening the locked unit, which is something, it sounds ominous, but it really is for our veterans who are, we call them wanderers, people who have memory issues, dementia, that sort of thing. And the locked unit is one of the most important pieces of this new building, is an ability to make sure that veterans who need to be monitored are monitored in a location where they're safe and secure. I mentioned previously the fixed dental clinic. It's the first in the nation, as far as we know, to offer fixed dental care to residents of a state veterans home. Really what it allows us to do is avoid the mobile dental stations, which were a challenge for our veterans with mobility impairments. To get them out to the mobile dental units are a trailer that offers dental care. It's a challenge for someone who's wheelchair-bound to access that care. And oral health is a significant indicator of overall health. And so we worked with Delta Dental, V4V, and Minnesota's Disabled American Veterans for funding on renovating a space to make sure that we could offer the best dental care that we could. We're working on making sure that all of our residents of the Minneapolis home have access to this and are utilizing it. We are discussing options with the Minneapolis VA. They have more veterans than they can serve that are receiving care. Dental care through the VA is not an easy access. Typically, it has to be a result of a service-connected disability. Dental care is one of those things that veterans have the most challenging time accessing. But if we can assist the federal VA at Minneapolis with their care load, eventually we'd like to expand fixed clinics to all of our homes, but this has only been open for about 8 months, and so we're working on making sure that we've got the best processes in place for that. But we're proud of the collaboration, again, to the commissioner's point about collaborating. Delta Dental, V4V, and DAV were all willing to contribute to the cost of the equipment there, and we're also working on the staffing of the provision of that care. And it's been a really successful program in terms of serving the veterans. We're still working on the business end of it to make sure that it is self-sustaining and that we've got all of the I's dotted and T's crossed in terms of making sure we're doing it the right way and utilizing our resources. So this slide is not in your packet. It dropped out at some point in transfer, but it is on this here, and we can answer questions as needed. With your support last year and Governor Dayton's support at the end, the bonding bill that was signed included $32 million total funding for three new state veterans homes. I've briefed you all on the process. It's a bit convoluted, but we are at the point now where we are finishing our pre-design and our engineering at all three of those sites. The goal at this point is to submit applications April 15th for the federal match for the construction costs. The locations at Montevideo and Bemidji will be 72-bed facilities. Preston is a little bit smaller based on their fundraising and their request. So Preston is going to be a 54-bed facility. We made a decision with the leaders in that community in conjunction with the legislative leadership. Do we want to go for 72 beds and have it be a lesser facility, or do we want to keep the quality of the facility as high as possible and make it a 54 based on the amount that they were able to collect? And so we went with a 54-bed target, and that's what we're designing for. The goal will be to get the application in. We're committed to that goal, and the federal match would be a 65% match based on how much these communities have been able to raise. And then the process begins at the federal level, and they'll be reviewing applications from throughout the United States. Make a decision sometime next at the end of this year, and we would know by the beginning of 2020 if we have federal funding for the construction portion. So by legislative direction and support of the previous administration, this is the process that we're on. We are on target in terms of the development of the sites. The communities have been amazing to work with. Our partners at MMB and Admin have been really helpful in developing the scope of the projects and working to identify the right contractors. We're using the same architecture and design firms for all three to save the taxpayer dollars and to make sure that we've got consistency across the board. And we've also got the CVSOs in those counties and the surrounding counties working with their local businesses. So, for instance, at Bemidji, they went up north and received some commitments from, at this point, unnamed windows and window companies to potentially contribute to windows to these projects. So those community collaborations are very important. I will note that the second portion of this is in 2018, the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs for the state budget construction, state homes construction budget was increased by 22% from 90 million up to 110 million. In addition, they announced an additional $575 million for construction grants to state homes. This is a significant influx of federal construction dollars for the VA specific to the state homes grant, so a total of $685 million. We expect that it will wipe out the existing waiting list. We're waiting on the release of the waiting list for fiscal year 19. We expect it sometime in February. Once we understand what happened to the 47 projects that were on the list last year, we'll understand where an application or multiple applications from Minnesota would fall on the federal list for funding. We don't know of any other states that are as far along in the process as Minnesota is in terms of having applications ready to get on that list. But once we submit those applications, it is in the hands of the federal VA. So we can provide an update once we get those applications submitted and later in the year understanding where we would fall on that list.
Got some questions here, but we've got our time getting short here. So, Senator Goggin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question I had is on the your bragging slide that you had for best in class. Just curious, for the dining service, do you guys partner with local farmers to bring fresh produce to the facilities?
Mr. Johnson.
Chair Anderson, Senator, I don't know the answer to that. I know that we offer, the dining does offer healthy options, but in terms of local or sustainably grown, that's something I'd have to explore for you.
Thank you.
Senator Stavinsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My head's been spinning since you showed the slide that this next year seniors will outnumber our young people in the state and the country, I would guess. This is mind-boggling, the ramifications across the spectrum in our society, and we've got to start talking about this more so. But I applaud you and the commissioner because you guys seem to be at the forefront of trying to solve and look into this problem. And I think you guys are a role model for that program of people being able to drop off their at-home daycare people. And that's something all of our communities should be looking at and looking at you guys and how you pulled that off, because that's going to, more and more elderly people are going to be taking care of their significant other and maybe need that cup of coffee or that grocery store run. And what do they do if they don't have any other family in the Twin Cities or the community? And so I just think what you guys are doing is just amazing. And thank you both for coming in today and having the wisdom and the vision of what's happening in the state over the next decade or so.
Chair, Senator, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate the presentation. We're running over our length of time, so thank you again for being here.
Chair, thank you. I'll do better next time.
Next on our schedule from Military Affairs, Adjutant General from the Minnesota National Guard, John Jensen, and Executive Director Don Kerr from Military Affairs. So welcome, gentlemen. I look forward to your presentation. And if Mr. Jensen, General, if you proceed.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Mr. Chair, and to the committee members. Good morning as well. I'm Major General John Jensen. I'm the Adjutant General of the Minnesota National Guard, as well as the Commissioner of the Department of Military Affairs. With me today is Colonel Retired Don Kerr, our Executive Director for the Department of Military Affairs. And on behalf of the over 13,000 soldiers and airmen of the Minnesota National Guard, Mr. Chair, to you and to all the committee members, we thank you for your leadership. We thank you for your support of our service members and our families. Mr. Kerr, next slide, please. Five key items for our agenda, and then obviously we'll have room for questions and discussion at the end, but please feel free to stop me at any time. Next slide. Mr. Chair, as you know, our guardsmen serve a dual status role, that we have a federal mission and a state mission. Our federal mission is primarily to prepare to fight and win our nation's wars and to protect our homeland. Currently, the Minnesota National Guard has 950 soldiers and airmen deployed across the world, and I'll show you in our slide set where they are. In addition to that, we are also prepared in a supporting role on behalf of the governor to support our communities and counties across the state of Minnesota. An example of that would be most recently Super Bowl 52, where over 400 Minnesota Guardsmen supported that event in support of the Minneapolis Police Department. And currently, you can see 13,149 is our current strength for our Army and Air Guard. So in terms of our vision for the organization, as I mentioned, fighting our nation's wars, protecting our country, and being prepared to respond to state emergencies while remaining to be the most trusted institution in Minnesota is very important to us. We take very seriously the challenge that we have before us and the resources that are provided to us by both our federal and our state government through our taxpayers. So my priorities as the Adjutant General, just as a reminder, I've been the Adjutant General since 1 November of 2017. I replaced Major General Rick Nash. Our organization is a people-centric organization. Everything that we do is based on the ability of our soldiers and our airmen to do their mission. Supporting them are their families. And so as the Adjutant General, my primary focus is on our soldiers, our airmen, and our families. And part of that because we grow our own, meaning that most of our leadership comes from inside the Minnesota National Guard in a developmental process. Leader development is a key responsibility of the agency. Organizational and safety and security gets to a wide range of things. But the one thing that's key to me is that we have a work environment that respects all of our soldiers, all of our employees, as well as our civilian employees there. But it could go as far as deep as facility security, as well as cybersecurity. So we're focused, again, throughout the entire organization on safety and security. And then, as I mentioned, fiscal and property responsibility, being stewards of the taxpayers' money to create readiness. That's what we provide to the Department of the Army and the Department of Air Force. Ready soldiers, ready airmen, and ready units. And finally, we have a long list of partners that we always work to communicate with and to partner with. That goes from our families, our employers, our state and federal elected officials, Department of Defense, Department of the Army, Department of the Air Force, National Guard Bureau, the Army Guard, the Air Guard, and then partners such as Croatia, Norway, United States Central Command, and United States Northern Command. It's just an example of a long list of partners and people and agencies that we communicate with. Our economic impact on the state of Minnesota is large, over $500 million last year in calendar year 2018. We're still accumulating our numbers for calendar year 2019. But you can see what we provide in some areas of the state. We're a very large contributor to the local economy. Morrison County, vicinity Camp Ripley, as well as in the Duluth region, we're the seventh largest employer in that city. And you can also see there, Mr. Chair, that primarily our resources come from the federal government, 96.5% and 3.5% provided by the state of Minnesota. Now we'll just discuss very quickly the unit configuration of the Minnesota National Guard. In our Air Guard, we have two air wings. The 133rd Air Wing out of Minneapolis, St. Paul International Airport. They fly C-130 cargo aircraft. Significant use of this unit over the last 2 years in support of hurricane response throughout the southeast sector of the United States, and you'll see those numbers coming up here shortly. But they can deploy as small as one aircraft in support of missions overseas as well as domestically or the entire air crew, Mr. Chair.
General, we have a question. Senator Bingham.
Thank you. No, Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm prepared to answer that question. The DOD budget was fully funded at the beginning of the year. So as it relates to our agency money coming from the Department of Defense, there are no issues whatsoever. What we are trying to do is reach out to our individual soldiers. For example, we may have a soldier or an airman who works for TSA. And so determining the impact on that soldier individually. And the reason why we're trying to do that, Senator, is because we have several groups that support our soldiers and our families. For example, the Minnesota Military Family Foundation provides grants to soldiers and airmen who are having difficulties for a given time. Just yesterday, our Duluth Air Wing reached out to the Coast Guard that's stationed up in Duluth to do something similar. We hosted a lunch for them, in part to help educate them on resources that are available in the state of Minnesota, because we think it's very important. So thank you for that question, Senator.
Please proceed.
Yes, Mr. Chair. In Duluth, the 148th, which I just mentioned, flies the most modern F-16s the United States Air Force currently fields, the F-16 Block 50. They recently returned from a CENTCOM area of operation deployment in 2018, where 500 airmen deployed overseas in support of operations in Kuwait, Iraq, and Syria. And that's kind of unique. Usually they don't deploy that large, but this time they did. For our Army Guard, you can see our units listed there, and I'll just run through them very quickly. Our Joint Force Headquarters, or our state headquarters here in St. Paul, our Combat Division, the 34th Infantry Division out of Rosemont and Invergrove Heights, currently deployed in support of Operation Spartan Shield throughout the United States Central Command area of responsibility. Kuwait, Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Afghanistan are just a couple of the countries where they're currently supporting operations. Our 1st Brigade Armored Brigade Combat Team, headquartered out of Bloomington. Our 34th Expeditionary Combat Aviation Brigade here in St. Paul. The 347th Regional Support Group out of Brooklyn Park. The 84th Troop Command out of Cambridge. And finally, the 175th Range Regional Training Institute at Camp Ripley. Those are our major headquarters. A jewel of the state of Minnesota and the Minnesota National Guard is our Camp Ripley Training Center, 53,000 acres, located north of Little Falls. You can see an economic impact to the local economy for over $72 million. In addition to military training, though, we also partner with other state agencies at Camp Ripley to provide opportunities for them. Key partners would be the Department of Natural Resources, Department of Transportation, the Minnesota Highway Patrol, and the Minnesota Homeland Security Emergency Management, for example. We have a statewide presence, and this is key to our recruiting, the diversity of our force, our readiness, and our ability to respond quickly in a state emergency. So as you can see, 61 facilities throughout 58 communities. We continue to add new facilities as we age out of some facilities and in some regards grow out of other facilities. In Arden Hills, we're currently just have broke ground this fall on the new headquarters for the 34th Infantry Division. But we're not specifically centered on the metro area as well. Behind that, we'll have facilities in New Ulm and Laverne as well. So we maintain our outstate view, our outstate approach to the Minnesota National Guard. As everyone here is very aware, 9/11 changed our country. It changed our Minnesota National Guard, where we left being a strategic force to an operational force, specifically meaning a force that was held in the reserve to now where we deploy every month, every day of the year. A term that was very popular before 9/11 was, you were a weekend warrior. In those days, our average soldier would train approximately 39 days a year. The typical Minnesota Army Guardsman in a regular year will deploy or will train over 50 days. And then if they are preparing for a deployment or actually deploy, that number can grow significantly higher than that. And you can see our contribution to the security of our nation since 9/11. Over 26,000 soldiers and airmen have deployed. And I think when we go back and recalculate that, it'll be closer to the 29,000 since 9/11. To places where we're currently deployed, 946 soldiers and airmen deployed, Kuwait, Afghanistan, Qatar, Korea, and Germany, and then on occasion into Iraq, Jordan, and Syria. Just last week, Command Sergeant Major Doug Wortham, my senior enlisted advisor, and I had the opportunity to travel to Kuwait, where we visited the 34th Infantry Division, the 851st Engineer Company out of Little Falls, our Air Ambulance Company out of St. Cloud, and the 147th Finance Detachment out of Arden Hills. And I'm happy to report that those soldiers are doing great. They're accomplishing their mission. Morale is very high, and they continue to receive the, and feel the support of our communities back home. So, again, while our soldiers are overseas, they can feel the support from Minnesota. And then just a quick list of some of the operations that we've been involved with since 9/11. While most of these are overseas, you can see that we do have a history back in 2006 of supporting the Southwest Border Mission, Operation Jumpstart, as it was named then. This does not account all of the training events that we participate in across the globe. Last year, we supported the European Command. We supported our Indo-PACOM command, our command in South America, as well as multiple training events here in the United States. In terms of the future, what's it hold for the Minnesota National Guard? We will continue to deploy soldiers and airmen across the globe. We are on track to deploy a total of 1,500 soldiers and airmen this year. We expect that in calendar year 2020 will be another 1,500 soldiers and airmen, with the possibility of calendar year 2021 of that increasing to over 3,000. So the requirement for the reserve component, and specifically the Minnesota National Guard, to continue to support our national security strategy across the globe is not lessening. In terms of our state active duty since 2005, you can see we've also been very active as well. And while we primarily train for our wartime mission, our go-to-war mission, those skills, those attributes that we bring to that mission also apply to everything that we do here in the state. And I just bring your attention to 2018 Super Bowl 52, where we supported the Minneapolis Police Department as well as the Bloomington Police Department in ensuring that we were able to perform their more mundane, static operations to allow our professional law enforcement agents to get out into the community and do a more traditional law enforcement mission in support. It was a great opportunity to work with local partners. As you can see, you know, while we do support domestic operations, our biggest support to domestic operations have actually been outside of Minnesota. You look at 2017, our hurricane support to Texas, Florida, and Puerto Rico. That was a significant contribution, primarily the Air National Guard and our C-130 wing, getting to those locations. Now, the key capabilities that we bring in our state mission, in addition to command and control, you can see the other nine listed there. Those capabilities all exist in the Minnesota National Guard. The Minnesota National Guard is very robust, and is because of our size, because of our over 13,000 soldiers and airmen, we're able to contribute in all of these key categories, and they're available to the governor for state emergency response in support of local authorities. We're never the lead. We're always in support of local authorities. We do have a couple of units that have a very specific domestic operation focus, the 55th Civil Support Team. This team primarily deals with the detection, identification of chemical and biological agents. They're used extensively, especially in areas where large groups come together, for example, the Super Bowl Vikings games, and I know they have been missioned for the Final Four. We have our second one, our Emergency Response Force. This one is very interesting in the sense that it's an additional mission to our soldiers. So our traditional guardsmen will have their National Guard mission, and now they also have this additional mission. And it would be in the response of a major emergency. And they can provide decontamination, heavy rescue, and medical triage. A very small group of our soldiers support our local law enforcement agencies in counter-drug program, demand reduction, analysis, and eradication. Capability that we are growing right now is our cyber protection team. Approximately 30 soldiers and airmen will help us develop a capability to help protect our state in the cyber realm. Key to doing all this is community support. Next slide, please. An initiative that the Minnesota National Guard started that has now become a national program is our Yellow Ribbon. And Yellow Ribbon, it entails a lot of things. We use the term here in Minnesota, Yellow Ribbon, to really kind of identify lots of our programs to support soldiers, airmen, and family. Specifically, this one here is a dedicated program that prepares our soldiers and airmen and families before they deploy, as well as when our soldiers and airmen come back, is to ensure that we help them reintegrate back into their community and back with their family. Through this program, we've been able to do great things as it relates to civilian employment. As soldiers return from theater, ensuring that we have everything available for them to continue their careers or change their careers. We've also been very proactive in working with our educational organizations, for example, MinSCU, to ensure our soldiers that are coming back into education have all the benefits available to them. And while it's changed over the years, it remains a very important part. And then our Yellow Ribbon networks, where we've reached out, where we have 90 networks that could consist of anything and everything from a county group, a city group, into a business group as well, 65 companies, most of our Fortune 500. Again, another program that was created here in Minnesota that has become a national program. And this program really links our communities, agencies, employers, groups, and individuals to our soldiers, our airmen, and to our families. A key benefit that previous briefers talked about as it relates to education, and this is true for our soldiers and airmen as well, you can see that our soldiers and airmen are eligible for both federal tuition benefits as well as state tuition benefits. The state tuition benefits, I will tell you, are very critical to the Minnesota National Guard, specifically to our Air National Guard. The federal benefits available to in the Air Force are less than what they are in the Army. And so you'll see, why is that number, as it relates to state benefits, bigger than the number for the federal benefits? It's in part because more of our Air Guard's eligible, as well as our more of our continuing service members are eligible, so a greater pool of eligibility. And then we also give back to the community as it relates to education as well. Starbase, a program that we have two locations for, St. Paul, Minneapolis, St. Paul, with our Air Guard unit there, as well as a new program up in Duluth focused on STEM. And you can see the outreach that we have been able to achieve since 1993. Over 50,000 students have reached that. We're very proud of our international partnerships, our long-serving partnership with Norway. Just in a couple weeks, we'll kick off the 46th iteration of their Norwegian exchange. And then we are equally as proud with our state partner, Croatia. We are now entering, it'll be our 22nd year with Croatia as our state partner. And we've seen Croatia mature from a part of Yugoslavia, part of the, while it wasn't technically part of the Soviet bloc, but certainly a communist government, to now that they're a NATO partner, they're an EU partner. So it's a tremendous relationship that continues to grow. We constantly are on look for other partnerships throughout the globe, whether it would be a state partnership like Croatia or an additional bilateral relationship like we have for Norway, in part because our soldiers and airmen like to operate in that environment. Many soldiers will join, many airmen join, for the opportunity to serve outside of their country. And then next slide, in terms of just our organization, who we are, sometimes people forget that the Minnesota National Guard also includes the Department of Military Affairs, or that, you know, the Department of Military Affairs is really our civilian component of the agency. I know many of you have worked very close with Don Kerr over the years, and you understand it, but that's not always as understood. And so we're an Army and Air component with a state component as well. And then you can just kind of see where we exist in terms of full-time manning versus what would be considered what we call a traditional guardsman. So you can see that our force remains a significant traditional, or, and I hate to use the term part-time, but that's a term that many people will use. Our soldiers and airmen have civilian careers, and they continue to support their country and their state through their service in the National Guard. So that's just a little depiction of that. And then although we gave you the numbers, there's nothing like a big eye chart right there to just kind of show the proportionality of our federal spending versus our state. And with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk to this committee and to thank you and the committee for your support, and I stand by for any questions that you or the committee may have, sir.
Thank you, General. Do we have questions? Any questions? Well, we do. I think that we have questions, but I think our time's getting short, so I'm going to wait for another day. Excuse me. And I want to thank you and Mr. Kerr for being here and sharing with us. It gives us a new insight. In fact, it gives us an opportunity to reflect back on who we're serving in our communities back home, because there's lots of vets that need your services, and we want to be a part of that and helping them get to what they need and go forward. So thank you again for your support. Thank you for being here to do a presentation, and have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next on our agenda, we have one Senate file, Senator Jasinski bringing forward Senate File 58. Members, that bill is in your packet. This is a bill that was presented, I believe, last biennium. And I do believe we've got some people who are going to testify along with him. So welcome to the committee, Senator Jasinski, and please introduce yourself and give us a little bit of background on what you're presenting.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. As a United States Navy veteran from 1986 to 1990, I'm happy to present Senate File Number 58, which is the Disabled Veterans Homestead Market Value Exclusion Administration Data Sharing Permission. Senate File 58 is pretty simple. What it does is it allows the county veteran services officers to talk back and forth with the county assessors to share data information about the eligibility for disabled veterans homestead market value exclusion. So this just allows them to talk back and forth to confirm eligibility. That's the simple version. So given the time, and I have some testifiers here, I'd like to just end with that and let them testify. And if there's any questions when they're done, I'd be happy to answer any questions. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Jasinski. Mr. Dilks, introduce yourself to the tape and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Trent Dilks. I'm the Legislative Director for the Disabled American Veterans Department of Minnesota, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this bill. On behalf of the DAV Minnesota, we fully support this bill. A little bit of background on the problem this solves is in 2017, the law was changed to stop the need for a yearly application for those who weren't disabled veterans who weren't permanent in total. That in 2018, when they were applying for their 2019 benefits, created a little bit of a problem because the veterans were told they didn't need to apply, which was correct by under the new law. The CVSOs, it turned out, couldn't talk to the assessors. And then the assessors were sending letters to the veterans to let them know they were going to lose this benefit because they hadn't gotten the information they needed. And so it was a kind of a perfect storm of nobody had the access and the ability to do what they needed and misinformation. So this would resolve that issue and allow for that sharing of information, relieve the stress on our disabled veterans, allow the county assets to speak to one another and really take care of that and take care of our disabled vets. So we are fully in support, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Dilks. Be like not being able to talk to your wife, right?
Exactly, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Hilgart.
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Matt Hilgart. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. AMC represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. And I don't need to say too much further because I think Mr. Wilkes nailed it right on the head. We are in full support of this, both as county commissioners, both as our administrators, our assessors, and CVSOs. Just more specifically, the data that was not being allowed to share because of Minnesota Data Practices Law was Social Security numbers. So each of those offices actually had the Social Security numbers, but they weren't actually able to share it with each other. So this is a quick fix. It should be remedy the situation, and we are in full support. Thank you very much for bringing it forward, Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgart. Senator Bigham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I don't know what happened last year with this bill, because it is probably one of the most common sense pieces of legislation that we have around here. You want to light up a phone of a county commissioner or fill an email box, this is exactly it, and it's a frustration. So this achieves two things. It really helps the county provide services, more importantly, to our veterans. And so you're helping two different groups there, and I applaud you and look forward to supporting this. What the question I have, Mr. Chair, is what happened last year? What did it just get tied up in a committee, or what?
Thank you, and
Senator Jasinski.
Senator Bingham, the bill was Senate File 2953, which became House File 2907, and was included in House File 947 in the omnibus school aid and tax bill, and was vetoed by our governor.
Yeah. Okay.
Senator Bingham.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Whatever certainly I can do to help move this through the committee process, I'm more than happy to do that. So I don't know what happened on the other side or what, but previous governor vetoing it. Let's just get it through this time and make sure it makes it through, because this is just one of those common sense things that helps our veterans and counties.
Any other questions for Senator Newton?
Mr. Chair and Senator Jasinski, I think this is a perfect example of a bill that should go forward on its own, go to the floor, and not be included in any kind of an omnibus bill. So good luck.
Amen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Newton and Senator Bingham, with your comments. And I fully agree. It just streamlines a government process and is a no-nonsense, common-sense bill. So thank you very much. And thank you for allowing me to be the first bill that gets through your committee this year.
Senator Rood.
Well, I'm just anticipating, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rood.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 58 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary and Public Safety Finance and Policy Committee.
Senator Rood moves that Senate File 58 be recommended to pass and be moved to the Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee. All in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Jasinski, you're on your way. Good luck to going to public safety and judiciary. I hope you get out alive.
Thank
Members,
you, Mr.
Chair. This is there's some goodies over on the left-hand side. There's some coffee and some juice and some other things. So if you grab some donuts or anything, be sure to do that. Members, at this point, the Veterans and Military Affairs Committee is adjourned.